Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And so their argument was like, you know, and they slept, you know, slept together in his constituency office, paid for by the taxpayer.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm John Ashmore, acting editor of CapEx. This week it was my great pleasure to be joined by journalist Marie LeConte, whose new book on Westminster gossip lifts the lid on how things really work in the corridors of power. We sat down to chat about the power of WhatsApp, clashing political cultures, and the fine art of coffee hopping. Okay, Marie, welcome to Free Exchange. Now, you're here because you've written a book, a very good book, might I add, called Haven't You Heard? Gossip, Power, and How Politics Really Works. I mean, can you tell us a bit about the genesis of the book and a bit about your own background? Because you worked as a diary reporter for a while, like you're quite, you know, ensconced in that world. When did you decide to come up with a book, and you know, how was the process of putting it all together?
And so, yeah, so as you mentioned, I was a diarist for quite a while, and it's kind of, I guess, how not quite how I came up with the book idea, but how it all started, because I came into Westminster via a kind of slightly unusual route, because I feel like, you know, normally people might come in through the lobby of, like, especially in journalism, or, you know, kind of, I don't know, like, you know, junior political reporter, etc. Whereas I very much came in by writing gossip, effectively by working for the Evening Standard's Londoner's Diary, at first as a kind of like normal diarist, and then after months of lobbying my editor, I basically became the political diarist, which is not a title they officially gave me, but they basically said they were fine with me using it. And you know, so kind of like for a year and a half, that's basically what I did. So I would cover what happened in politics, but via the medium of going to book launches, going to the bars in Parliament, going to events, talking to people, then kind of covering all the personal and the, you know, again, slightly gossipy behind the scenes, etc. So that's clearly like something I've always had quite a keen interest in. But I think even beyond that, so I kind of did that. And then after that, I worked as a politics and media correspondent for BuzzFeed, which it turns out I didn't enjoy. I didn't just enjoy doing straight political news. And basically, I think what I found is that I thought that what I was covering and what I was writing about was a lot more insightful when it was gossip than when it was just doing, you know, the political news of the day, watching the chamber, whatever. I felt like I had a much better grasp of what was actually going on when I was doing diary gossip. And I feel like I was kind of giving my readers as well a better sense of what was actually going on. So I think that from kind of the beginning, I've always had this sense that gossip and the kind of personal and interpersonal relationships was what mattered in Westminster. So that's where the book idea came from, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting because often we, you know, people slightly dismissively refer to gossip as tittle-tattle or something like that. But what comes across in the book is that this is actually pretty crucial stuff. It's not the, you know, what you see on the telly is only, I think you say, it scratches the surface of the sort of thousands and thousands of interactions that go on every day. I mean, what do you think was, what did you find most surprising when you were kind of researching the book?
I would say, so there's quite a few bits in the book about the civil service, and that was, for me personally, I think the most interesting bit, because I, you know, I already kind of, you know, by this point knew how Westminster works and how Parliament worked, and, you know, and obviously how political journalism works, etc., so all the other bits of the book, but I'd not, because obviously, you know, because of the relationship I think civil servants have with journalists, I didn't have as much of an understanding, I guess, of how civil servants really functioned within Westminster. And I think that, you know, I did have this idea of, you know, they're kind of like the grown-ups in the room, they're the grey suits, and, you know, and everything there is a lot more organised, a lot more, you know, formal and so on. And actually, so I ended up interviewing a number of civil servants, so all the way from quite junior ones to former permanent secretaries. And yeah, turns out the civil service is a mess as well. You know, and is completely based as well on rumours on what, you know, you think the minister may want because you overheard that X said in a pub, etc. And there are so many examples in the book, so I think, of civil servants basically, because again, I'm sure we'll come back to that in a bit, but I guess the broad thesis of the book is that informal conversations step in when formal channels don't work properly. And I think, yeah, one of the main examples in the book, and at least the one I think I found the most interesting, is the lack of good communication between especially kind of like mid-ranking civil servants and their minister. And so what happens is that a lot of the time, civil servants will kind of try and reverse engineer what they think their ministers want as policies and work on those. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So there is an example, which I'm not going to spoil too much, but of effectively like sweeping NHS reforms under New Labour, but with one bit of like some contracts in hospitals not being touched because everyone had been convinced in the Department for Health that Blair did not want those touched at all. And then there's this big meeting in Number 10 to talk about all the big reforms and everything changing. And yeah, long story short, Blair had never said anything about these contracts and definitely did want them reformed as well. And it's just been, oh, but we thought, because we'd heard that, you know, X had told us that Y had said that, you know, you'd said you didn't want this changed. So I think, yeah, for me, that was definitely, I think, yeah, that finding out that the civil service is as much of a mess as the rest of Westminster was the biggest surprise.
Yeah, I think especially for people who aren't in sort of working in and out in Westminster all the time, they might be surprised at just how ad hoc everything seems to be, and a lot of things seems to be sort of done on the hoof. Another thing that I found interesting in the book was about, and certainly reflects from my own time in the lobby, was how the kind of geography of Parliament has actually shaped the way gossip gets told and political operations. So, for instance, you talk a bit about Portcullis House in the book.
Yeah, but I mean, I nearly, like, that's going to sound so pretentious, but I nearly wanted the book to do a bit of sort of like psychogeography of Westminster. Because, again, and that's not really an original point to make, but the physical spaces we inhabit will always have an influence on the sorts of relationships we have with each other. And that's particularly true, I think, of Parliament in general, of Westminster as well. I mean, Portcullis House is really interesting as an example because it was, like, it's now the beating heart of the estate, effectively. You know, it's where people meet, it's where they have coffees, it's where they plot a bit, I guess, it's where they have lunch, when it generally was just meant to be sort of like overspill room, mostly for like staffers to maybe grab lunch or something. But, you know, but that was that. It was never meant to be this massive space. But it just turns out that I think Parliament never really had this kind of massive space, which is quite modern and does look like a canteen. And also, I think, crucially, because I think everyone gets something from that, is somewhere you can see everyone. And I think it's really fun. Like, you know, I'd encourage anyone who's not quite of Westminster to try and somehow like go for lunch or a coffee there once, be brought in there by someone, because the choreography of Portcullis House is really interesting. So you'll see, you know, MP sitting down for lunch, you've got some journalists who kind of walk around like sharks, you know, waiting to see one MP leaving the herd and kind of going, hello, can I sit down with you for lunch? You've got, so I think, and that's mentioned in the book, like one lobbyist who basically plays a game of who can bring me in because he doesn't have a pass, who can bring me in. And then from there, I'm just going to try and coffee hop with different people at different tables for as long as I can. So I think it is a place that has become perhaps, yeah, one of the main spaces, I think, in politics, which is quite odd.
Yeah, that's one of those little things that maybe people don't know about, is that you can't be in the palace without a pass holder. And similarly, you talk about the stranger's bar, and people do the same sort of thing, don't they? They sort of go in hoping to find an MP they can cotton on to.
It is such a weird, you know, and I've done that literally like in the past fortnight. But so strangers, for people who don't know, is a bar in Parliament where you have to be, so I can't remember who exactly, I think you have to be an MP, a clerk, or a few other things to buy drinks. So anyone can come in, but these are the only people who can buy drinks. And so you do find yourself, you know, been there more than enough times. But you do kind of find yourself brought back to being about 15 and trying to loiter somewhere, trying to get someone who's 18 to buy you beers, effectively. Like, I have had to, as you go see MPs, I vaguely know, so like 10 p.m. going, hi, if I give you a £10 note, can you buy me a beer, please? But again, you know, that changes the dynamic entirely, I think, of how people interact with each other. And it gives MPs, you know, it's very much like that bar is very much like MP spaces and everyone else can be there. But they're, you know, it is very much their space. And I think that influences the way people interact with them and how they interact with everyone else.
I think you mentioned this as slightly akin to being at high school at some point. It definitely occurs to me that you're often having to try and kind of introduce yourself to people that you, you know, it's in a slightly awkward fashion. And, you know, and I mean, was there a moment when you were a diarist, was that a sort of skill that you had to perfect over the months and years you were doing it, kind of the smooth intro, if you like?
Kind of, but I think every journalist has to do it. So I think one journalist in the book actually said, you know, the entire thing is that you need to find one thing you have in common with some MP or whatever to latch onto so you can chat about that a bit. And yeah, that's kind of how you build a relationship. And he was saying, you know, with one minister, I had nothing. I tried so hard and I, you know, eventually was like, oh, I went to Catholic school. You know, that can be my one thing, which is like such slim pickings. But so I think, you know, everyone, obviously as a diarist, I think it was slightly different in that. Because I think what's interesting with the lobby journalism and how it works, etc., is that, you know, it's very codified. So if you're, I think the idea, like if you're an MP and you go talk to a lobby journalist and it's just like a chat in the corridor, you know, they will not report, you know, on what you say, in especially if it's a conversation that happened within the palace. With a diarist, I think you don't have that element of trust as, you know, brought to you by your profession. So I think you have to build that kind of sense of trust as a person, which makes it harder. But it's still, yeah, again, I think everyone does have that. And as you said, in it is very high school and you kind of go up to like quite the cool kid and you're like, hi, you know, I'm cool as well. I'm cool. We can be cool together. So it is slightly weird because, again, I think at the end of the day, if we're all very rational about this, we're all in Westminster for a reason. So, you know, if you're a journalist, you want to talk to an MP to get stories. If you're an MP, you want to talk to a journalist to get the word out there. Lobbyists, you know, that's quite clear what they do, etc. But it's never quite done that way. There's always got to be that layer of like, no, but, you know, we'd hang out even if we weren't in those jobs, even though both parties most of the time know that not to be true. But there's got to be this sort of friendliness to it.
Yeah, it's always a strange one, isn't it? I think another thing that's interesting is that tension between someone being a source and being kind of your friend and how to negotiate that. I mean, do you think that is kind of, it's definitely a problematic sort of an area for journalists?
Oh, it definitely is. And it is part of the reason. So I've been freelance for just over 2 years and I write features about politics. And part of the reason why I didn't decide to pursue a kind of like career in proper sort of like political news reporting is because I found that personally very hard. I guess also maybe because I'm just quite a naturally sociable person and so I make friends quite easily. And the problem was that, you know, once I make friends, I'm like, well, I don't want to betray my friends, which is not ideal, you know, and which I recognise in myself entirely, which is why I kind of decided to step out of that. But it does become a weird thing because it's either you end up having some sort of uneasy friendship with, let's say, an advisor or an MP. I think advisors are more interesting as well because MPs is quite, you know, again, is very codified. They're a member of parliament, you're a journalist, etc. But, you know, so like SPADs and PADs and all of that. So it's either you have this sort of weird friendship where actually they feel they have to watch everything they're saying around you at all times. And in that case, everything becomes quite stilted and becomes, you know, not very fun. So it's either that and it's uncomfortable for them, or you cross that barrier and it's like, no, we are genuinely friends now, and the advisor, you know, like, will trust you and know they can say stuff to you and then you're not going to report on them. But then the problem is, you know, like, there's one thing I can think of a mate of mine who told me about a year ago, you know, this story. He was like, obviously you cannot write this at all, but, you know, X and Y and Z happened. And it was a properly massive story. Like, it would have been, I think, one of the biggest stories of my career if I decided to, like, betray him and, you know, give it to, like, the Mail or something. But obviously I didn't want to betray my friend, so it put me, and he did tell me as a friend, not as a journalist, so it did put me in an uncomfortable position in the end. So I think, and yeah, and maybe I think, you know, better people than me have managed to work that line better, but I still find it to be a struggle, and I think that quite a lot of people do.
I think it's particularly, we're coming up to conference season, and the pseudo-socialising of conference drinks parties was something that really sort of made me want to leave the lobby, actually. It's the look over your shoulder, you know.
Yes.
This is So pretty much any time you go to a political drinks, I think people, especially if it's an up-and-coming MP or a junior minister, they're always kind of scanning the room behind your head.
Yeah, there was one not that long ago. I'm not going to name them, but again, a very much sort of like very ambitious sort of like youngish MP, and we were chatting at some, I can't remember what it was, but at some event. And it was fine, and I could see that basically like another journalist who's more senior than me was quite nearby. But was busy talking to someone else. So I was like, I can tell that the MP wants to talk to them and not me, but that's fine. We can have a bit of a chat. Like, we know each other a bit. And I swear to God, so we were chatting and it was like a fine, up, pleasant conversation. And the other journalists became free because they're sort of like the person they were talking to left. And they literally just mid-sentence, just turned around and went to talk to that journalist and left me there. And it was like, oh, come on. Like, we both knew what was going on here. I knew I was the placeholder, but go on. Let me finish my sentence.
Yeah, exactly. And what do you think, when you were writing the book, were you conscious of, you mentioned at one point that if you're reading this, you're probably interested in politics. But were you conscious of how it might be perceived by people outside politics?
It was very much written. I mean, so the main thing I think about the book for me is that I really wanted it to be very accessible, because I think that, you know, even as someone who obviously massively cares about politics and has been working in it for several years, there's quite a lot of books about politics I want to like, but I was just, you know, very dry or trying very hard to be sort of like very clever and like, oh, you know, you'd only like this book if you already have this amount of knowledge about politics, or like, you know, you'll get these references, etc., which I don't find particularly interesting. And so I kind of, because I guess, yeah, the moment that I think ended up being the slightly eureka moment in terms of, like, you know, why I wanted to write a book and what I wanted the book to be about, was kind of that line between, before coming into Westminster as someone who obviously, like, knew about politics, followed it closely in the papers, was on Twitter, etc., and thinking, okay, well, I know how this works, it'll be fine, that, you know, I can come into Westminster, I'll know how this works. And then kind of coming in over the first few months being like, whoa, turns out I knew nothing about how politics really functions in this country. And it's kind of that, you know, and the book is very much like, in the first whole part is kind of mapping out the first few weeks and months of someone coming into Westminster for that reason. So the book is kind of hopefully, obviously, you know, I want it to be interesting to people who work within the bubble and know it quite well, but I did want it to be mostly for people who have a keen interest in politics, but, you know, don't work around it and will probably never work around it, but want to find out how everything works.
And I think it comes across that you seem keen to stress that, you know, these are just people, and that, it, you know, I'll start that again, actually. and, I mean, do you think that the public's perception of politicians, there's certainly an anti-politics mood, not just in this country, but elsewhere. Do you think if they knew a bit more on reading this book, do you think their impression of it would be improved or not?
Well, so if you'd asked me that a few weeks ago, I would have said, yes, I think so. Like, I didn't want the book to be a sort of like, you know, defence of the bubble. But I did, I don't know. But you know, it's kind of a call for, I guess, slightly more compassion. And yeah, and again, the understanding, because it does come up in the book quite often, that, you know, everyone who works in politics is a person, and people are flawed. And, you know, no matter how good you are, how clever you are, how well-intentioned you are, you will be flawed because none of us, you know, are perfect. But at the same time, so there was I saw a review recently on a website that said, you know, that was very complimentary and very nice and said, you know, I learned a lot like from this book because I don't know that much about how politics really works. It was really interesting, blah, blah, blah. And it's convinced me that SW1 needs to be razed to the ground and sort of like set on fire and like we need to start it all again from scratch. And I was like, oh, that's not what I had in mind when I wrote it, but fine.
It's a view, yeah.
But yeah, no. So, but I do think that, you know, as you kind of mentioned, there is this, I mean, distrust obviously of politician, but I think this gap between politics and the public at the moment on many different issues in many different ways. And I do think that, yeah, slightly greater understanding of how stuff works may help a tiny bit at least, kind of like bridge that gap.
And yeah, I think it's better than this sort of thing, and examining the mechanics of how stuff really kind of, it gets more into what people's personalities are than kind of a sit down with Piers Morgan or The One Show, you know, with the Prime Minister going, oh, which, you know, what's your favourite jacket? Or something like that. I mean, I wonder how, in terms of political, let me start again, actually.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
In terms of tactics and the kind of political game, how important do you think this kind of rumour mill is compared to just having a plausible leader, a good strategy and good policies? Do you think it's a kind of sine qua non, or it's something that adds to an existing good package?
So I think you can probably get to the top without really, really using gossip. So I think that, you know, interestingly, because obviously as I was writing the book, Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the opposition and Theresa May was prime minister. And these are two politicians who don't partake particularly in kind of parliamentary socialising and plotting, etc. So that was quite interesting. But I think they're both kind of exceptions to the rule. So you can certainly do it. I think if you do it that way, you play in hard mode. And also I don't think it always works. So, and I'm sure kind of that they'll both be looked at again. So both Corbyn and May as leaders who, you know, as leaders who I guess were very much of their time and probably would not have risen to power if it hadn't been for those very particular circumstances for one and the other. I do think you need it because again, you know, and that crops up in the book again and again, but MPs don't always vote, you know, because of the policies they care about, or, you know, whether one person agrees with them on X area or whatever, like it is quite personal as well. And I think, you know, leaders rise and fall based on how they treat their MPs and, you know, who their friends are, who their enemies are, etc. So I do think it is something you need at the very, very least to be conscious of. It is definitely important.
I think it's also, and you sort of touched on it there, like, if Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May have a weakness, it's perhaps a lack of kind of personal sensitivity to how things are being perceived, and that being good at the informal side of things implies other things about you as a politician.
You know, entirely. And I think, I can't remember who said it, but one of the people I interviewed in the book made the point that the informal matters so much in politics because the only two things people want to know and need to know about you in Westminster are what sort of person are you and what do you really want? And that's basically that. And, you know, and if you can figure that out about someone, you basically know them and know them well enough that you can work with them and get close to them, etc. And I think, yes, yeah, so like your character as a person matters a tremendous amount, which is why, because I've had people ask, you know, what's different about gossip in Westminster when every office, you know, will have gossip, etc. And it is because I think gossip matters a lot more. Because again, the personalities, people's personalities, and what they want, their aims and their character, is, you know, is what at the end of the day will quite often make or break them.
Another thing that really comes through is that however well informed you are, and you know there are some fantastically well informed, ear to the ground, shoe leather political journalists out there, even they are only getting a fraction of the net amount of gossip in Westminster.
I know, totally. So I try to ask a number of spads, mostly, and some other sort of like political people, you know, how much gossip do you think, like how much information do you think journalists end up getting? And they all guess sort of like different bits. So I think it was between 5% and 30%. of, you know, how much journalists actually know. So I think, yeah, there's two things. A, the amount of stuff that actually doesn't go out. And I think Miranda Green, who's a former Lib Dem advisor, and then went the other way around, is now a journalist for the FT, having seen both sides, she said, you know, it's actually quite spooky how much never makes it to the press. So I think there's that. But nearly more interestingly, there's the amount of stuff that journalists kind of know about or can't quite stand up or have heard but don't really know what to do about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, rumours, again, like a lot of political so much of political journalism is basically, you know, someone telling you in a bar, over coffee, whatever, by the way, you know, it's not necessarily the main item on the agenda, but, you know, just at the end, like, by the way, you know, I heard that, I don't know, X MP is a creep, for example. But it's not from me or secondhand, but, you know, I kind of, like, it's in the ether. And then what do you do as a journalist? So I think there's so much that you sort of know, or you maybe know, but you can't quite stand it up, or stuff that you definitely know, but there's no way you can actually publish it. So there's a lot of information that kind of travels around and never leaves the bubble. So not necessarily for sort of, like, nefarious reasons of, like, the elites protecting one another, but just because actually a lot of the stories, like, a lot of what counts as stories in politics, it's really hard to stand up and to actually publish in a paper and be sure that you wouldn't get sued over it.
We're seeing the result of all these kind of interpersonal relationships playing out now at the highest level. I mean, it's not... You see the odd comment about it, but, I mean, to what extent do you think these kind of personal schoolboy, particularly among the Tory top brass, how much of that is influencing the way that sort of British political history has been played out in the last few years?
And I think, obviously, it entirely matters if you look at the kind of triangle of Gove, Cameron and Boris, you know, and which is basically, like, if you read Tim Shipman's books, a lot of them are basically on those relationships. And so I spoke to him. He's one of the people I spoke to for the book. And he did argue that, you know, if you did not know about actually all the so-called gossip and all the personal, like, interpersonal relationships within people at the top of the Conservative Party, you would have been completely dumbfounded by what happened at every single stage. So I think, you know, it does matter entirely. When you look as well, I've always found that quite interesting, Osborne and the absolute hatred he has for Theresa May, as you can see in his many, you know, like in the many Evening Standard leader columns and cartoons and everything, you know, back when she was PM. And that's clearly something that started out in the cabinet as well. And maybe in a different world, actually, he could have got behind her, but he didn't, because clearly, you know, some stuff happened there, like, besides the fact that obviously she sacked him. So I think nearly everything will have a touch of the personal to it.
I mean, we mentioned Jeremy Corbyn earlier there. Do you think his rise has kind of overturned the conventional wisdom about needing to have, like, a good network and all that kind of thing? If you can, because you talked about him getting elected at a certain time, but it's like he's almost consciously bypassed the whole Westminster bubble and just kind of gone straight to the public in a way that other politicians maybe haven't.
So yes and no, I would argue, and this is very much like that's actually quite separate from the book, but is something I'd quite like to write about at some point, actually. But I think, you know, there are networks around Jeremy Corbyn, there are social networks, is that they're not the ones in Westminster. So from very early on, you know, you had, and especially because I think a lot of the networks had been built around the student protests and anti-cuts protests in 2010, 2011. So a lot of the people kind of got to know each other then and marched and organised for direct action, etc. Then those networks kind of lied dormant for a bit because they didn't have much to do because Ed Miliband was leader and so on. And then once Corbyn became a possibility, all of that came back up. So you definitely did have, you know, kind of... So again, there was not necessarily as Westminster-based, but he definitely had all of those people around him, most of whom all have the same drama that, you know, that we see in any other sort of, like, campaign team or kind of, you know, outriders, etc. And some of it occasionally sort of, like, bubbles up on social media, but I think that we see less of because again, I think those people don't necessarily have the relationship with journalists that other, you know, leadership teams or whatever would have. So I do think that he does have those people, and there's kind of, you know, there is that, but there is the Corbyn bubble as much as there is the Boris bubble, etc. It's just that it's slightly sort of off-centre and not, again, and also not physically in Westminster, which, as we've talked about, is an important thing. If anything happens within, you know, further than a 15-minute walk away from Parliament, no one will ever find out about it.
I think that, and something that else that comes across is this idea that it's not like, we refer to a rumour mill as if it's one solid thing, but really it's like mapping 100 different spider diagrams on top of each other, because, like you say, like, some of these people have relationships that go back to school, even. A lot of them from university, which is a product of our kind of quite closed-off red brick you know, 10, 12 universities basically supply the entire political class.
Well, yeah, and I think that's why, and it's mentioned quite a lot in Haven't You Heard, but so I think like, it's the whole thing about known unknowns and unknown unknowns. So, you know, so there might be, you know, people that I know, I know they're sort of like mates, or I know they clearly get along or whatever, but I don't know what they're talking about, what they're plotting about, what their secrets are. But then beyond that, there are so many people who I don't even know, you know, might be friends, because again, maybe they went to university together, or maybe, you know, something completely random happened, like they met when they were 21 at a house party, and, you know, long story short, they're still really close mates. So there's a lot that you don't know, but you don't even know, you know. And, you know, and again, so I remember, so one friend who's a former Labour advisor, and we went to this event together, and she bumped into this Tory minister, and like, big hug, and they were like, oh my God, have you been in so long? And I was like, what? And yeah, it turns out, you know, they were housemates at uni. And so there's so much of that. So, you know, I completely agree. I think that you can never get a full picture. And what's made it even harder, I think, is the kind of WhatsApp supremacy in SW1. And the fact that at least for quite a long time, you could see like physically who was speaking to whom. So, you know, in the parliamentary bars, in the tea rooms, in Portcullis House, in wherever, in the Red Lion. But now you can have lots of people kind of plotting and talking to each other quite a lot. But you wouldn't even know these groups exist.
And we haven't even mentioned Twitter, which has obviously multiplied the sheer volume. It's multiplied the volume and probably watered down the quality of gossip over the, particularly in the last sort of 4 or 5 years. I think when it started, it wasn't quite as, you know, widespread in Westminster.
Well, I think, yeah, it's the combination of Twitter and WhatsApp. And so is the point made by Jim Walton, I think, the media editor of The Guardian, who said that Twitter and WhatsApp are killing double sourcing in Westminster. So his point being that, so normally, you know, the way you'd hear a story, I don't know, something happened, and you hear it from a Tory MP, and you think, okay, that's once, you know, one person has told me that, I need to find someone else, preferably either from a completely different wing of the Conservatives or from another party altogether, to see if they'd heard that as well. And then, you know, if they have, it's double source, etc. But the problem is that stuff travels so quickly now that you can, and I've had it before, but, you know, you think you've double sourced a story as a journalist, but actually you've talked to two MPs who are just in the same WhatsApp group, and they've just heard it from the same person in the same WhatsApp group. And because things just travel so, so fast. And obviously an MP is not going to say to you, like, unless they're close to you, say, oh, yes, no, we've all heard that rumour because, you know, X posted it on the WhatsApp group. So you do end up having to play catch up, I think, as a reporter quite often, because stuff just spreads so, so quickly.
And just turning on a related note, at the beginning of the book, you talk about how this kind of, the way the British system works, in a very informal, convention-led, sometimes underhand way, is completely different to how things work at the European level in Brussels. Maybe not in Brussels behind the scenes, but in the way that decisions are made formally there, and you've got 27, 28 people you've got to get together. I mean, how much do you think that clash of cultures has affected the way that we've negotiated with the EU and perhaps surprised them in how we expect to just muddle through a lot of the time?
I think it's completely, you know, besides of like everything else, I think that's not, you know, that's one of the reasons why basically the entire Brexit process has gone as poorly as it has, because, you know, everything you see in Britain is usually, it's based on fudge, you know, and it's based on, like, can we get that small concession? Or, like, you know, maybe if you give a speech that, you know, uses those words, then, you know, our supporters will think that blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, let's just have one meeting about this. And come on, can we not, you know, we're all gentlemen here. Like, you know, can we not just, like, change that slightly, etc. So I think there was a big expectation. And you can still see it now in the backstop, you know. So, and it has basically become a joke now of, you know, every other week you'll have someone saying, but, you know, or we could just put a small time limit on the backstop, just a small time limit. And that's not how it works. So, you know, the EU, obviously, because it has so many countries in it to deal with and factions within these countries, etc., everything needs to be agreed, ratified, printed in black and white. And once it's done, we do not get back over it, etc. So I think it was a completely sort of like different like clash of the cultures. And the EU as well has found it, I think, quite hard to deal with it. So absolutely it is. And I think, you know, to an extent, other national governments will always have that problem with the EU as a body. But I think Britain is especially bad for it.
Now, obviously, you grew up in France before you came to the UK as a student, am I right?
Yep.
And I mean, the difference between political culture over the channel, especially in the way that journalists treat politicians, is kind of unbelievable to me. Because I remember it came out sort of decades after the event that François Mitterrand had an entire family on the side. I mean, when you came to the UK and saw how things were done here, was it a bit of a cult shock, or do you sort of already know that?
It sort of was. I was aware of a sort of like tabloid culture, which is not something that we really have in France. But I think there's a few different aspects to it. So the first one is that, you know, and that doesn't just apply to politics, but I do think we have a very strong sense of a right to private life in France. So whoever you are, and even in one of my favorite examples was when François Hollande was found by Closer magazine to be having an affair at the time. There was a backlash afterwards against Closer. Not against
him
the president.
On his motorbike, wasn't it?
It was, you know, but there was, a backlash against the magazine because they were like, well, you know, we don't want to know. That's his life. You know, if he's still just doing it, you know, doing his job, then we don't care. We shouldn't have to care. So I think that, A, culturally, there's quite a strong sense that no matter, you know, even if you're in politics, you deserve the right to have a private life. And then the second thing, I think, which is more, so that could be an entire other podcast, but I think the French press sees itself differently from the way the British press does. And I'm not saying there's a right or wrong way. I think maybe somewhere in between would be a good place to aim for. But I think, you know, the French press can take itself quite seriously, and I think takes its role in society and in democracy and the Republic quite seriously. Even if, you know, obviously it can have a bit of fun, but at the end of the day, there's a kind of like, you know, great sense of, you know, the free press, like, you know, one of the pillars of the Republic. Whereas I think that in Britain, which is not something I'd fully appreciated until I moved here, there's a sense of, you know what, we're kind of rascals. We're kind of here to have a good time and, you know, and make our readers have a good time. And if you read, like, there's lots of really interesting books, actually, about the early days of the Sun and the Mail, etc., which kind of prove that. And so I think one of my favourite bits in the book is, so talking about public interest and actually, you know, the difference between gossip and news, but also how you publish effectively gossip. And the answer is, you know, having talked to people who work at tabloids, we can sort of make the public interest angle happen if there's something we really want to publish. And so one of my favourite examples is Simon Danchuk, who at the time was so busy, was sleeping with this woman, and on the face of it, not really a story, because he was single at the time, the woman was single, it was entirely consensual, she wasn't underage, like, you know, it was entirely just, you know, man has, you know, relationship with woman. But the way they managed to cover it was because apparently part of their affair had happened in his office against his desk, I believe. And so their argument was like, you know, and they slept, you know, slept together in his constituency office, paid for by the taxpayer. Yes. Taxpayers deserve to know what happened.
It's a brilliant get out for any story, isn't it? The taxpayer's expense.
Exactly. And so I think that, you know, you would never, ever see that in the French press. So no. There's a sense of mischief, I think, that France doesn't quite have.
And definitely, I think the French, I used to read Le Monde every now and again, they see themselves as almost a branch of the Academy rather than...
No, very much so, yeah.
All right, well, on that salubrious note about Simon Danchuk, we'll end it. Marie, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.